Saturday, February 6, 1982. An interview with Daryl Neighbors at his home at 271 Park Avenue, Long Beach, California. The interviewer is Ann Andres.
Well, maybe I should begin at the beginning of your life, then, Barry. Were you born in Long Beach?
No. Mm-mm. I was born in a small town in Missouri called Mountain Grove. There were 2,000 people there in 1905 when I was born. And there were still 2,000 people. That's a beautiful little town in the Ozark Mountains, right close to Arkansas. And I lived there through the 7th grade. Mm-hmm. My mother had been born there. A big family, 7 sisters and a brother. My first grade teacher was the same first grade teacher my mother had.
Oh, my.
Still teaching.
Well, yeah.
That goes on in little towns, I guess. I knew everybody. I had 6 or 7 aunts and uncles. Everybody knew everybody in that little town, of course. At the end of the 7th grade, we moved to Memphis, Tennessee. Which to me then was a big city, streetcars and black people whom I'd never seen.
Yeah.
In Mountain Grove, there'd never been a black person there.
Mm-hmm.
And of course the schools were segregated and there were Jim Crow laws on the streetcars, the blacks rode in the back. But there were lots of them. No antagonism that I ever saw. Most of them, a lot of the women who were attached to white families for doing washing and cooking and raising the babies.
Mm-hmm.
Those white folks would trust their babies with those black women completely. I went through high school there.
What kind of work did your father do?
Okay, Carol. Okay.
I think we're...
Well, in Mountain Grove, my father had been born on a farm about 5 miles away from Mountain Grove. All those people, my grandparents and most of the people who lived around there had migrated at the end of the Civil War from Virginia.
Oh.
My mother's mother and grandmother lived in Running Springs, which is now part of Washington, D.C., on the Virginia side. My dad's people all came from Roanoke. And they were, in religion, Dunkards. Do you know what Dunkards are?
No, I don't.
Like Quakers, they were even more strict. Women never wore jewelry or makeup. My grandmother always had a little black cape on, a cap on top of her head. No color in their clothing, all black. The men had beards.
Mm-hmm.
They very closely knit. If one of them got sick or in trouble, the others would pitch in and help. When I was a little boy, my dad was in business in Mountain Grove selling John Deere plows and wagons and stuff. And I heard him say many times that when a Dunkard came in to buy, he never questioned their credit because he knew the man would pay, or if he didn't, the church would, the congregation. Well, then, his mother was alive. July was 15, 16 years old, I guess, a very sturdy woman who outlived 3 husbands. And we had 3 generations of children, her own big family, plus grandchildren, and last I knew she had a great-grandson. Living on a little rocky farm. Her husband had died when my father was a little boy. They'd just gotten out there. My dad said the little one-room log cabin in which she and all her kids lived was still there when I was a boy.
Mm.
One room, big fireplace at the end with hooks on it, and a big iron pots in which she did all her cooking. A ladder which went up to the attic where everybody slept. By the time I came along, she built a two-story white house next to it, but the little cabin was still there. He said he never went to bed, but she wasn't sitting by the fireplace, so the only light they had, weaving cloth and mending shoes. He never got up in the morning, that she wasn't already up getting breakfast for all of them before daylight. And as soon as the chores were done and she scooting them off to school, she went out and worked in the garden to raise food. Well, my mother was born in a little town in Mountain Grove, and my father, her father, had the first little store there. And that was still there when I was a little kid. The town had moved in the meantime from when the railroad came through. I guess part of his trade was with Indians. He'd bring in furs and stuff from around them. And then when he'd get a load of those, he'd pack them in a wagon and drive all the way to Memphis or to St. Louis to trade them for merchandise, which he'd bring back. His first wife had died right after they got out there. And my grandmother's first husband had died right after they got out there. Each one had a little girl. They married, and then they had six more children of their own.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how did I get on that? Well, my dad was in business there. Well, then we went to Memphis. Mm-hmm. You weigh more, you don't weigh more about the
well,
part of that.
No, you went to school in Memphis.
Yeah,
you
went to high school.
And then, did you go to college in the
school? That was one of the days when, right after the First World War, well, I started the high school in 1917 during the First World War.
Yeah.
So, ROTC was mandatory for 4 years of high school. I wore a uniform every day. in ROTC, all the boys did. I graduated there. I was editor of the first annual of high school I'd ever had in 1923. From there I went to the University of Tennessee in Knoxville for 2 years. Lived in a fraternity house in which Esther Schiefhofer was a brother.
Oh. same time?
Yeah.
Oh.
I knew him. I started off in pre-legal because I wanted to be a lawyer. And that was the year of the Scopes trial in which the teacher named Scopes had been fired for teaching about evolution.
Yes.
And old Brian, the proverbial presidential candidate, had taken on the job of representing the state. And that famous criminal lawyer from Chicago. Decided to defend Scopes. The case was held in the summer, and Brown actually, I guess, died because of the heat and the emotion he went through. Anyway, those Tennesseans held on to that law, and that had just been passed in the legislature, and all the good law professors left the university.
Oh.
They said, we can't teach law except as it evolved. The law evolved. And by this new law in Tennessee, we can't teach it. So they left.
Mm-hmm.
Kiefhofer was then a senior. And talked to me. He said, I have to finish here. I can't transfer now. But he said, I'd suggest to you, you transfer to some other school if you can, or change your course. So I changed to economics.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, from there we moved to Florida for a year during the big Florida boom. Remember hearing about that?
About that.
Yeah, 1920, 5, 6, 3, 4, 5, 6. A huge land boom developed in Florida. People from the east and Michigan and the coal countries were buying land and going crazy. So my dad and the people in the automobile sales company with whom he worked wanted to kill them and went to Florida to get in on the land boom.
Mm-hmm.
That was in 1925. And it was just beginning to end as we got there, first in Tampa. Then we settled in Orlando for a year, and it went on for a few months, but then began to collapse, and it was a very serious collapse. So in the middle of it, I retreated to got a job in the trust department of a bank to have some money. By the time we left, in the summer of 1926, everybody had quit. We saw thousands of houses in all stages of construction and foundations were almost complete, just abandoned.
Mm-hmm.
There was no market for them at all. A horrible collapse. A bank for whom I worked went broke. Most of the banks did. So we came out to California in 1926.
So the whole family came?
My mother and father.
I was
with them, yeah. I dropped out of school at the end of my sophomore year. And we looked around and my dad decided to... Well, first we went to Anaheim, where he became sales manager for an automobile dealer. And he got me a job. They put me in a brand new little car to call on all the owners of cars 3 or more years old in Orange County. Well, Orange County in 1920 six was nothing like Orange County now. Mostly orange groves and walnut groves. But I traveled every road. I called on every house in Anaheim and Santa Ana and Orange. Well, there was a car over 3 years old. There were lots of them. When I found somebody who was maybe thinking about buying a new car, I'd make a note of that and the salesman would follow up. Well, anyway, I got to know Orange County. It always bothered me I hadn't finished college, and we'd gotten acquainted with an architect in his family who had an office in Los Angeles, and he offered me a job down there as a messenger boy, which would allow me to go to school.
Mm-hmm.
So I entered UCLA. Classes in the morning, and then I would go to the architect's office in the afternoon and sit and watch the draftsman work, and I'd stay there when he had something for me to do. But he went broke the first year. And then I got a job as a chauffeur from Mrs. Pellissier. If you've been in Los Angeles, you've been to Pellissier Square, the Pellissier Building at Western and Wilshire.
I'm not familiar with it,
now. Well, she was a real old-time lady. She and her husband were French, very. And they'd had a little house at 7th and Grand. what became 7th and Graham in Los Angeles. In the early days of Los Angeles, and by that time she was, when I knew her, she was trilingual. She spoke English, Spanish fluently, and French was her native language. Her brother-in-law, one of the Pelliciers, had the big Pellicier dairy over in Whittier, still does, and the family does. Anyway, her husband, I don't know what business he was in Los Angeles, at any rate, she said in the morning people would drive their cows along Grand Avenue and up on the Bunker Hill. And they crossed a little wooden bridge not far from our house, which woke us up, and at night they'd come clattering back with their bells again, and my husband said he was tired of all that noise, so he went way out in the country and bought 600 acres, which is now Western Wilshire in Austin. They built a big house in the center of it, which is where she was living when I came along. And so he could raise sheep and they could live in the quiet countryside, which they did. So they took people, when people came out from Los Angeles to see us, it was an all-day event. They'd drive out here and have dinner and then drive back. That was a great experience. She still owned the land on which, at 7th and Grand, on which the Bank of America had built its head office building. And one of my tasks was every once a month she'd have me drive her down there to collect her rent. She always went personally to collect it rather than having it mail it.
The bank was there at that time?
Yeah, 12-story building. And she had stock in the bank. She was a very wealthy lady.
I think that's kind of a fun story, to go collect the rent from the Bank of America.
That's right. And then she had stock in the... talked to me one day about her stock in the Security Trust and Savings Bank, which was talking about merging with another bank, the Pacific Southwest Bank. She had to decide what to do, something about her stock. And I didn't know what she was talking about, but she was talking about it. You know, that's the first I ever heard of the Pacific, Security Pacific National, which it became.
That was after Security had bought Farmers and Merchants Los Angeles?
Yeah. No. Farmers and Merchants was still a separate bank at that time.
In Los Angeles?
Yeah. That came much later. At any rate, I got through UCLA and came here to Long Beach.
You said you came to Long Beach in 1929?
Yeah, after UCLA. My family had lived here all the time. My dad had gone in the real estate business with the son of Sam Sulliver. The company was called the H.P. Sulliver Company.
Oh, okay.
And Sam Sulliver with Warren McGrath and Frank Strong. Must have been about 1920. Had bought the marshland that became Belmont Shore and Belmont Park. And that was marshland, just like Sunset Beach. And they had hired an engineer named Collins, the brother of Larry Collins. Larry, I don't know where he was then. And they dredged dirt muck out of what is now our Marine Stadium in order to fill in Belmont Shore and Belmont Park above high tide, because it used to flood it. And here at the foot of Belmont Heights, Livingston Drive, that was kind of the shoreline. By 1929, I had finished sales in Belmont Shore, most of the lots. I heard Sam say that when the first plans they laid out for Belmont Shore had nice curving streets, wider, and he and McGrath got options on all the beachfront property and asked the city to acquire all the beachfront to make the lots in Belmont Shore more desirable. And the city council at that time said, oh, that's too far out in the country. We don't want to own that beach. So then they had to redesign Belmont Shore with the very narrow streets and very small lots, which are there now. That was the only way they could do it economically. But after they'd sold the lots in Belmont Shore, McGrath and Sullivan separated. McGrath took the vacant land in Naples north of 2nd Street.
Mm-hmm.
And Sullivan took the 90 acres of sand that became Belmont Park.
Yeah.
And in 1929, he had just finished putting in streets and streetlights and alleys, curved streets, the way they had wanted to do Belmont Shore. They started selling lots. My dad was in that company. I had a sales office at Broadway and Bay Shore. I had another one at 2nd and Bay Shore. One of the old Belmont Shore offices was at Granada and Ocean, and survived many years as the Ark, a beer bar.
Oh, yes, I know of that building.
That was one of the sales offices for Belmont Shore. As in those days, for subdivision sales like that, were you here then?
No, I didn't come to Long Beach until the beginning of 1963.
Well, downtown Long Beach, there would be women sitting at little tables with beach umbrellas at the sidewalk with advertising brochures on Belmont Park. I remember when we first came here, somebody had made a subdivision in what became Firestone, a town up...
Southgate,
yeah. Here in the Weaver New, and we took one of the trips. Well, what happened, they'd give you a free trip, bus ride if they had enough people or somebody's car. You'd get there and there'd be a tent. They'd have a free lunch. And then you had to listen to a high-powered orator.
Mm-hmm.
And the orator we heard at Southgate, as near as I can remember, there was a guy named Ole Olson who became famous later for developing San Clemente. He made Southgate sound great. He talked about all the industry that was going to come and stuff. Well, we didn't buy there, or my dad didn't. But when I came along in 1929, he and his company were doing the same thing to sell Belmont Park. They had these women downtown. They'd stop the people and get a free ticket. Well, first they'd give you a free boat ride around the harbor.
Oh!
And then they'd bring you down there, and there was a big tent where they'd give you a free lunch. And then they put you in a big tent, like a Chautauqua thing. You ever go to a Chautauqua?
No.
Huh?
No.
Well, that's Missouri. Well, this was a Chautauqua City. This was a Chautauqua City. That was long before my time, but I know what it was because we had it in Mountain Grove, too. One of the lecturers we had here was Leonard Netkemper, who was a speech teacher at Poly High.
Oh.
He was a great lecturer. He made long beats on really wonderful. And after that, then the salesman would get hold of their prospects and try to get them signed up on lots. Well, they were plugging away selling those lots in Belmont Park. About October, was a big stock market crash, October 1929. Sales had been getting harder and harder because there was a depression in real estate. It was slowing down. But after October 1929, they just couldn't sell any more lots. People were scared to death.
Mm-hmm.
My dad had taken, well, the company he was with began to get in trouble financially, ran out of money, and he took title to 6 lots in Belmont Shore for, that was all there was left that he could get. Every lot that had been sold, were sold under contracts in those days, monthly payments on contracts, came back. They all defaulted. My dad ultimately had to let his 6 lots go. He couldn't keep up the taxes and assessments on them. Sam Sullivan, who was worth repeatedly, and I believe it, well over $1 million when they started that thing, by 1931 or 2, was broke. A real tragedy. He had built a house on the ocean at the narrow part of the peninsula as you leave Bay Shore.
Mm-hmm.
It gets narrow there. It's right,
yeah,
across from the little, yep.
Leeway?
Yeah. I think it's gone now. But it was a 2.5 story house, and in front of it he'd had a cave excavated. And he had a bulkhead built down in the sand. It was about 10 feet thick. And then he created a big game and rumpus room down there. In those days, long before the breakwater, the waves would pound on that bulkhead of his, a solid wall, and would shake the whole house.
Mm.
But he had big parties, a big fireplace and game table. He had big parties down there. Anyway. Well, I was working for the company in those days, and not on the subdivision, but I had a little office at one room frame. Real estate, typical real estate office at the corner of 2nd and Granada,
mm-hmm,
on which now sits the Bank of America.
Mm-hmm.
1930, 31, 32. I'd started off because I was going to be all right, but by then it was pretty desperate. My dad had lost all his money. He was sweating to sell, and I was sweating, and it was awfully hard to do anything. I almost turned in an application to join the Air Force. But I didn't. Then I became aware that banks, buildings, insurance companies, building loans were foreclosing on real estate. People couldn't pay. I had a friend who worked at the Security Trust and Savings Bank at First and Pound. And for Sullivan, I had, he had held on to some of his property, for instance, the corner of Second and Bay Shore, where the library now is.
Yes, yeah.
That was one of the old sales offices. And I had made a lease on that to a man who was going to create a roller skating rink. And the fellow had gotten far enough to get a nice floor put on, and then he went broke. And then another young fellow came along.